From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Every year when the MacArthur Fellowships are awarded, it's big news. It's a coveted prize that recognizes achievement and supports a diverse group of people who are doing work that has shown great promise. Two recipients in the Philadelphia area were winners, and we wanted to make sure we acknowledge them on Radio Times. They've both been guests on the show in the past. Angela Duckworth is a psychologist whose area of expertise is something she calls grit. Jeffrey Brenner is a Camden physician who's pioneering new ways of delivering healthcare to the urban poor. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. will reach the end of its borrowing authority tonight at midnight. That's when the Treasury warns the U.S. could start to default on its debt. The Senate is working to reach a bipartisan deal to lift the debt ceiling and reopen the government. NPR's David Weldon reports House Republicans tried yesterday to win support for their own plan and failed.
House Speaker John Boehner tried to rally his fellow Republicans behind a plan that would reopen the government for 2 months and raise the debt ceiling until early February. Other provisions, though, drove off any support from Democrats, and it failed to sway hardline conservatives who continue to demand a dismantling of the Affordable Care Act. By day's end, the plan was dead. It's now up to the Senate to act, and both its Republican and Democratic leaders say they have a workable compromise, one that would have to clear both the House and Senate quickly to calm financial markets. David Weldon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Some conservative members of the House are criticizing Republican senators for the bipartisan legislation, even calling them part of the Senate surrender caucus. Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins rejects that description.
I would describe ourselves as a bipartisan group that's trying to get a solution and do what the American people want us to do, which is to govern responsibly.
Collins spoke to NBC's Today Show. The congressional uncertainty has prompted a credit rating agency to warn the United States. Fitch says it will review the U.S. government's stellar AAA credit rating for a possible downgrade. The company placed the U.S. credit rating on a negative watch yesterday. Talks on Iran's nuclear program resumed today in Geneva. The Iranian delegation is continuing its effort to gain relief from economic sanctions. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports Western officials call the current talks detailed and useful.
As Iran's foreign minister met with Catherine Ashton, the lead international negotiator, after day one of the talks, his deputy, Abbas Araghchi, met with members of the U.S. delegation in a rare Iran-U.S. bilateral meeting. A State Department official said the meeting lasted about an hour. The increased engagement is raising expectations that progress is more likely with the new Iranian team in place. But no details on how Iran may be willing to restrict its nuclear program have been released so far. Western officials say major sanctions relief can only follow concrete, verifiable steps by Iran to assure the world it's not seeking a nuclear weapon. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Geneva.
Officials at Miami International Airport have reopened one of their terminals. It was briefly closed this morning after a bomb-sniffing dog detected something suspicious on a pallet. The unidentified item has been removed. The all-clear has been given. There have been no injuries. On Wall Street, investors are encouraged. The Dow Jones Industrials are up about 182 points. They're at 15,350. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities at kresge.org.
This is WHYY, 61 degrees in Philadelphia. I'm Joanne Allen. Good morning. Today is Election Day in New Jersey, which is unusual for a Wednesday in October. Voters will choose a senator to fill out the term of the late Frank Lautenberg. WHYY's Dave Davies reports low turnout is expected, making the outcome hard to predict.
Democrat Cory Booker is far better known and better funded than Republican Steve Lonergan, but this is a special election in more than one sense, says Larry Sabato, a nationally known political analyst from the University of Virginia.
Honestly, in my entire lengthy career of political analysis, I can't remember many other Wednesday elections for anything.
Add in that this election is on a Wednesday in October, 3 weeks before the general election, and Sabato says you've got a formula for such a low turnout that
you pretty much guarantee that only the political activists will participate.
And that gives supporters of Lonergan a diehard conservative hope. Some remember little-known Christine O'Donnell winning a low-turnout Senate primary in Delaware to capture the Republican nomination and envision Lonergan's enthusiastic followers doing the same thing. Nate Persily, an elections expert at the Stanford Law School, says unpredictable things can happen in very low-turnout contests.
When you don't know who's going to turn out or what the factors are going to be that can decide the race, then I think it's possible that candidates who are on the fringes, or not even on the fringes, just ones that have low chances of winning normally, might actually win.
Sabato and Patrick Murray, who directs the Monmouth University poll, say in New Jersey, which on national issues is a largely blue state, Lonergan will need more than just the conservative faithful to carry the day. That's why Lonergan has focused on Obamacare, NSA surveillance, and other issues he thinks will appeal to voters beyond his base. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The polls will close at 8 tonight in the Garden State. The Flyers hosting Pittsburgh tomorrow night, and the hand-wringing goes on over who will QB the Eagles against Big D on Sunday. 61 degrees in Philadelphia, partly cloudy, mild today. Passing showers are possible, and highs are expected to be near 75 degrees this afternoon. You're listening to WHYY 1006.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The MacArthur Fellowships, these so-called Genius Awards, were awarded late last month, and two of the recipients have regional connections. Angela Duckworth is a research psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania who studies how grit and self-control can be strong predictors of success. She says that these qualities are both teachable and perhaps even more important than things like good grades or IQ or even talent. Jeffy Brenner is a primary care physician who founded the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. It works with chronically ill, frequent users of the healthcare system, providing a network of care to this vulnerable population. Both of our guests have been on Radio Times before to talk about their work, and we're excited to have them back with us together here on Radio Times. Angela Duckworth, nice to have you with us, and congratulations on the MacArthur.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here, and Jeffrey Brenner, thank you very much, and congratulations to you as well.
Thank you. Very exciting to be here.
Nice to have you both back, and Angela, have you come back down to earth? I have to say to our listeners, both of you were talking before the show, which is, what do we do with this money? What do we do with this money?
Yeah, I haven't exactly figured that out either. I've come back to, you know, the funny thing about the MacArthur, as Jeffrey knows, that you get the phone call 3 weeks before you can tell anyone. So from a psychologist's point of view, it's fascinating. You know, what happens when you're just bursting with news that you want to share with loved ones and you're only allowed to tell one person? I, of course, told my husband.
Right.
So I had at least 3 weeks prior to this to habituate, and my feet are on the ground.
So you feel habituated?
I think so, yeah.
How about for you, Jeff?
I got a call in the middle of the day and had a busy day of stacked up meetings, and I didn't pick up my cell phone and clicked it off, and luckily picked up the office phone, and then had to go back to the rest of my day in the next 3 weeks.
And,
it's
and,
very strange
and keep
experience.
A secret. So you
exactly.
Both are good secret keepers?
Can yes, we, can only we told my wife, and she kept the secret.
And she kept the secret as well. What do you like? We call it, you know, for better or for worse, the so-called Genius Award. Are you comfortable with that, Jeff?
Not at all. I mean, I don't know that you'd look back at all my decisions and say those were great decisions.
Really? Genius decisions
yes,
on your part.
Right.
How about for you, Angela?
Well, as somebody who studies everything except talent, I guess I would say that, you know, genius maybe isn't the right term for people who are productive, and I guess that's what the award is supposed to be rewarding. But if you look at the root of genius, right, G-E-N, to create, I mean, maybe that is the appropriate word. Maybe we should redefine what it means to be a genius.
But what I find interesting about the MacArthur, which is that it both acknowledges the kind of work that people are doing in this country, and seems to be saying there is promise in this work. We want you to do more of this work, Angela.
Yeah, I think that is the expectation of the award. So that's the from those to whom much has been given, right? Mm-hmm. Much shall be expected. I love that quote, and I hope to do something better and different, I guess, than I would have been otherwise. And we were talking before the show, how would you use this money? I guess the key question is, how could you use this award to do things that you could not otherwise find mm-hmm. funding for?
Well, and I know from the, both of the kind of work that you do, I mean, funding is such a big issue, looking for, finding, asking for money.
It's a huge challenge. Trying to deliver better care at lower cost anywhere in the American healthcare system would be a challenge. Doing it in the poor city in the country is sort of a double challenge. So it's an exercise in stubbornness. So I think it's the stubborn award.
The stubborn award as opposed to the
grit
genius
award.
The grit award. Yes, I see a theme beginning to develop here. But have you thought about, Jeff, how you want to spend this money? And we talk, it's $600,000+ over a 5-year period.
One of the foolish things I did was to open a private Medicaid practice in Camden and did that for about 5 years. And if you're looking for a business opportunity, I don't recommend New Jersey Medicaid private practice in Camden. And my rates kept dropping, and I simply couldn't keep the office open. I can only run from room to room to room so fast. I can only work so many hours and so many Saturdays. So I had to close the practice. It's currently boarded up, wow. as are many primary care offices in New Jersey and in Camden. And I have a business loan to pay off. So the sad irony of it is part of it will go towards paying off the business loan.
And keep the office shuttered.
Yes.
Let me go back to you, Angela, and just so our listeners understand the kind of research you have been doing, this thing called GRIT, which you've talked about that on Radio Times before. Tell us what you mean by GRIT.
By GRIT, I mean passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. And the reason I study GRIT is because gritty people tend to be the high achievers in society, whether that be in academics or in, you know, professional life. And I also study self-control, which is somewhat related but different. Self-control is the ability in the moment to resist temptations and distractions. And, you know, self-control people tend to be grittier on average, but you mm-hmm. find exceptions. You find some very gritty people who actually have a diagnosis of ADHD.
Well, and I wonder, because I know you worked for a couple of years as a teacher, whether it was being a teacher that you began to think of some of these ideas.
Absolutely. So as a classroom teacher, I taught math in middle school and high school settings for about 5 years total. And I would say that the singular observation that I have, and one that I couldn't shake, I was just puzzled by it, was the fact that kids who did really well in my class weren't always the brightest, at least by their test scores and IQ scores and so forth. And then I also found the opposite pattern, right? Some super high achievers who you look at their standardized, you know, IQ or achievement scores, and they're not fantastic or stellar. And I think what it came to me is that so much of accomplished in life, and I would just say that this is not only true in fourth grade or eighth grade, but just in life, is, you know, sustained high quality effort. And how do we get kids to have, you know, high quality time on task? And these characteristics, you know, grit and self-control really mm-hmm. enable you to do that.
Well, are we talking about just kids or all of us just trying harder, working harder, living up to our potential or our alleged potential?
Well, my 10-year-old daughter said to me once, just out of the blue, "Oh, mommy, I figured out what you do. You know, you're trying to get everybody in the world to work harder." And I thought that was roughly true. I mean, I do think so many of us could be doing more. I would say this, there are people who are working hard enough, and there are some people who maybe you could argue are working too hard, but they are in the minority, and I think for many of us, we're below our potential.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me go to you, Jeffrey, because you're a primary care physician.
That's right.
And had been, as you said, opened an office in Camden. Mm-hmm. Was it some of your experiences in Camden that got you thinking about the kind of work that you're doing now?
Absolutely. The patients that always fascinated me the most were the most complicated patients, and just what about their life course and their life history got them to that point, and what could I do as a primary care physician to change that trajectory? And you would have a really dramatic impact on some patients and much less impact on others. And I got really fascinated with what it would take to have a sustained impact on complex, high-cost patients.
Well, in fact, you borrowed some ideas that the police have used, the mm-hmm. kind of Comstat idea. The idea is that there are certain areas within a city mm-hmm. where there are high utilizers, where there's a lot of activity, kind of a hot spot.
That's right. About 10 years ago, the city of Camden peaked again as the most dangerous city in the country. And a whole group of people from Bratton's turnaround at the New York Police Department came down and were working on Camden and began to learn how they used data, how they thought about data, and then how they built managerial system to respond to that. In healthcare, in education, and in policing, a small percentage of citizens, students, or patients are driving much of the cost. In a school, a few kids in a class are driving much of the discipline. In a school, a few families. And in a city, a few citizens are driving much of the violent crime. And the problem in all these systems is we do a bad job of pivoting to the variable needs, and we really ignore the outliers. Mm. So in healthcare, if you're sick, We do a great job of cutting, scanning, zapping, and hospitalizing, but we don't do a good job of just talking to you and taking care of you.
Well, and just to throw some statistics out here, you found that something like 1% of the patients in Camden represented about 30% of the healthcare costs.
That's exactly right. And that's true all over America. If you look at a typical employer group, that's true. If you look at the state of New Jersey, it's true. If you look at the whole country, everywhere you look, a small percentage of patients are driving much of the costs.
And was there a patient in particular that got you thinking about some of these sort of hotspot ideas?
Yeah, you know, we really, as we began, we got a hold of a data set in Camden of the billing data from all three hospitals, and I just got fascinated with the outliers. And as I saw my practice going out of business, and I saw the hospitals tripling in size, we're building a new emergency rooms, we were hiring more specialists, buying new gamma knives, and spending money on technology, I was looking in the data and seeing how much money we're spending on cases that I thought were preventable. So we went out and met the first patient and got very involved in his case and used him as sort of the root cause analysis for all the failures going on.
Well, in fact, this was a patient, I guess, you were profiled in the New Yorker a couple of years ago, a patient with a pseudonym of Frank Hendricks, yes?
That's right. That's right. So I spent an enormous amount of time in the hospital at his bedside, just getting to know him, and then followed him home and got to know his family and, you know, found out that he didn't want to be in the hospital, that the hospital is a really terrifying place to be. But we had created a false choice architecture, that we hadn't given him better choices. And because we ignore patients like him in the outpatient setting, you know, he wasn't getting his needs met and therefore was going to the hospital.
He was hugely obese, morbidly obese. He
That's
had
right.
all sorts of physical ailments, had spent
right.
seemed like almost half of his life in a hospital dealing with one form or another of his conditions.
When I met him, he'd been in a major academic health center in Camden for about 2 months.
Wow.
He'd been in the ICU, he'd nearly died. And, you know, he stopped going after we began to work with him.
But, you know, what's interesting is that while your Medicaid office was going out of business, all these hospitals with all this new technology was being built in the same city.
That's right. I think it's really a metaphor for what's going all over the country, which is we are overspending on hospitals and we're underspending on the basic stuff. And in many ways, we've been incredibly successful in the last 50 years. We should be proud of all the incredible things we can do. We can pull you back from the brink of death. We can transplant your hearts and lungs. We can even cure cancer now, certain instances. But we're not doing the basic stuff well. And we have 85 million baby boomers headed to the most expensive delivery system in the world. And we have no idea how to deliver good care to them every day.
Well, I want to pick up on something you said, Jeff, and toss it to you, Angela, about this sort of hot spots, even within an education system, that there are probably a small number of kids that need an extra amount of attention and care.
Yeah, I'll definitely answer that. But I guess I wanted to also know whether the outliers, you know, the ones who are really sucking up the healthcare dollars, I guess I want to hear more after I give you my response about, you know, the extent to which those things are really preventable, basic things, as mm-hmm. opposed to, you know, the, well, you would have to spend, you know, $1 million on the technology to solve it. But my quick response to you is, you know, as every classroom teacher knows, there is this kind of topography in the classroom where, yeah, most of the kids are on task and paying attention, but those two or three kids, you know, you don't really, it's not clear what you should do with them because on the one hand, if you ignore them, they really do disrupt the rest of the class. And that sort of seems unfair that they can suck up 85% of your attention, even though they're not 85% of the students. On the other hand, what if you didn't, right? And so how do we manage that? Some could also argue that the most ethical thing is to spend all of your time with them because they are the neediest in that way. So I don't think there's a good answer. And I think what our work really emphasizes is, you know, what to what extent could you develop strategies or run things in the class or in the school in ways that would really lift the tide for all of the boats, right? So that that at least, you know, you should have a reduced frequency of those things and you would be able to help those kids who are the neediest, but also at the same time help the kids who are already at the top of the class.
And we're almost up at a break here, but one of the things that you are finding out is that this grit idea is a teachable idea.
You know, everything
people can learn this.
People often ask me, well, character is taught, but intelligence is innate. And we can say more after the break, but I would just say that everything psychologists study, including character and intelligence, is both.
It's both taught and innate.
That's right.
Good to know. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Angela Duckworth. Also with us is Jeff Brenner. They are both this year, two of this year's recipients of the MacArthur Award, MacArthur Fellows. Angela Duckworth is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And Jeffrey Brenner is the founder, executive director of the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Haddonfield Friends School supports WHYY. The Fisher Roseman family from Collingswood, the DeFlumeri family from Philadelphia, the Salam family from Marlton, and families from over 30 towns have chosen Haddonfield Friends School for their children's education. Tuesday tours are available from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. on any Tuesday. An open house will be held Sunday, October 20th from 2 to 4 p.m. Details and more information available online at haddonfieldfriends.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's the first day of the fall membership drive here at WHYY, and I want you to become a member. You're listening to Radio Times. Now take that next step and become a supporter. You depend on us, and we depend on you. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at our secure server at whyy.org. You'll be glad you did. Promise.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents the Mendelsohn Club's 140th Anniversary Concert, Friday, October 25th in Verizon Hall. This program of celebratory works for choir and organ includes Benjamin Britten's Jubilate Deo, Louis Vierne's Solemn Mass, and Charles Ives' Psalm 90. The evening features organ soloist Michael Stairs and commentator Michael Barone of American Public Media's Pipe Dreams. Tickets for the Mendelsohn Club's 140th Anniversary Concert at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Angela Duckworth. She's a psychologist who has doing a lot of groundbreaking research into the areas of grit and self-control. Jeffrey Brenner is a Camden physician doing pioneering work in delivering health care to the urban poor. Both this year's recipients of the MacArthur Fellowships, also known as the Genius Awards or the Stubbornness Awards. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Angela, let me go back to you and even take us into a classroom. I know you're doing some work with some schools in the area, including Upper Darby, Cherry Hill, other places as well. When you're talking about teaching, you know, grit or teaching self-control, how do you do that? What does it look like?
Well, I should first say that, you know, we're just at the beginning, right? So if behavior change is the, you know, new frontier possibly for the 21st century, and I guess that's my biased view, we're just at the beginning of that work. But I will say this. I mean, the basic idea is that there are strategies people can use that don't depend on, you know, better myelination of the frontal cortex or anything that changes your genes, just strategies that you can use to fare better in situations where, for example, in self-control, you're conflicted between a temptation that feels really good right now, you know, Facebook, chocolate frosted donuts, you know, whatever it is for
all
you.
All of that.
They're all good. They all feel great. Or versus, you know, whatever, your homework, the salad, you know, taking a walk instead of sitting on the couch. So strategies, I think the best way to think about strategies is, first of all, thinking about the Greek root, which is strategia. That is the Greek root of the English word strategy, and that translates roughly to military general. And I think the idea is, you know, given the same resources, the same number of soldiers, and the same number of, you know, tools, what could you do that's just more clever? So, for example, if self-control is an issue for you and you can't stop going on Facebook and, mm-hmm. you know, you find that it's 10 o'clock at night before you started your homework, are there ways that you can physically change your situation? Put your cell phone in a drawer so you don't see it. You know, put it on. Oh, my daughter, actually, my 10-year-old said she heard me lecturing, actually, about this topic. She turned her cell phone off. And just that kind of 15-second delay while you have to wait for your cell phone to power up kind of took the allure out of texting. And she said to me the other day, she's like, you know, I haven't even used my cell phone in 3 days. Is this because I'm kind of, you know, too lazy to turn it on? So that kind of strategy, hiding the Halloween candy, all those things that I think a lot of us have picked up over time, those might be strategies that are teachable to kids who don't come upon them spontaneously.
Well, it's interesting because it feels like, I don't know if it's true or not, that we live in a very distractible world. I mean, it seems there are so many shiny objects that want our attention.
That's right. I mean, you know, you don't have to go very far to look to see the philosophical or the religious quotes, lead me not into temptation. You know, Aristotle, Plato, you know, they all wrote about this conflict, Freud. But what might be different, I would argue, in the 21st century is that, you know, Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley have gotten very good at tempting us. And, you know, things taste really good. They're fun. They're just so many diversions. Mm-hmm. And they're, I think, arguably more potent than they've ever been.
And when we think about grid, I mean, I think about it as a kind of stick-to-itiveness. The idea is that I'm gonna work my way through this issue or through this problem. But you have to feel connected or some kind of passion about what you're doing too.
Absolutely. So grit is not just, you know, sticking with things, although of course that's an important part of it. There has to be something to which you are sticking, you know, mm-hmm. some guiding north star for you. And I think that's a really important point to make, because I don't want parents or teachers to come away from this and kind of just oppress their children into doing things and working hard. The kids have to really care, and that's part of the challenge of grit. Mm-hmm. Finding things that you are really interested in, and I will just add that it's not just discovering things. It's kind of like falling in love. There's some work there, too. There's some work there to mature your interest, to go deeper. And that's not always just kind of something that happens to you.
Well, let me pick up on that and throw the grit question, I guess, at you, Jeff, because you're working with a population of people, high users of the healthcare system, as you described with this one particular patient, multiple problems. Can we even think about grit when someone is trying to sort of work their way out of poverty, perhaps, and out of all the problems associated with poverty?
Absolutely. We've begun to think a lot about who our patients are, and you know, I think that we're way behind what we need to know in what drives healthcare spending and healthcare costs, and really understanding more deeply the drivers. We need ethnography, psychology, sociology to really help us with that. One of the things we've done is very in-depth interviews with our patients, and one of the most overwhelming themes that came out is the impact of early life trauma. Death of a parent, physical abuse, sexual abuse, divorce, in later on, as people hit their 40s and 50s, not mastering the skills of life. And one trajectory of that is to end up in the hospital or the emergency room. So around the country, as we've worked with many other sites, they're all finding the same thing. And there's actually a robust literature on this that's sat really dormant. People have not used the literature, but there's a wonderful study done in the Kaiser Health System about 10 years ago, looking at 15,000 middle-class patients. They gave them a survey that counted up the number of adverse childhood events. And that number is more predictive of almost any other number we have of your likelihood to use healthcare services, the total spend in healthcare, obesity, substance abuse, and smoking rates. So I think we're just at the beginning of figuring all this out.
But what you're really talking about is the potential lifelong impact of unresolved trauma.
Yes. And my best advice to anyone listening, if you don't want your children to end up as a high utilizer of healthcare services, mm-hmm. be really nice to them when they're kids and take great care of them.
But it's interesting to think about, you know, grit and how that applies to something like unresolved trauma.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, our lab has undertaken the same kind of work. We actually administer to several large samples of children, you know, we call it the negative life events inventory, and it is just this count list of, you know, my parents are fighting a lot, my parents got divorced, there's been violence in the home, I saw somebody get shot, you know, my best friend moved away. And you simply count up the number of events that children report experiencing in the previous 6 months. You can then in turn predict how less self-controlled they'll be. So they fall in self-control as a function of these negative life events. And actually, it's so large, this effect, that you don't need kind of really mm-hmm. sensitive laboratory measures. Teachers, who are, of course, blind often to these internal family issues, will note measurable changes in students' behavior and the decrease in those behaviors that are positive and the increase in behaviors that are negative mm-hmm. over time.
And this is about I mean, if you feel as if you're just dealing with so many conflicts, how do you control yourself, right?
So there are multiple possible reasons why this might be the case. One possibility that's been argued recently is that when you are dealing with a lot of things that are urgent and require your attention, you just have fewer cognitive resources to now control yourself, and that's why you're more impulsive. Alternatively, there's an evolutionary explanation for this, which says if you find yourself in an environment which is uncertain and threatening, the adaptive thing to do is to be reactive, go with your first impulse, you know, suspend reflection, metacognition, and just go. And I think that's another explanation which is sort of separate from like, well, you just can't do it because you don't have enough resources. And there may be others. But I think the, you know, this kind of recent development where we're looking at adverse events in people's lives and seeing its effects not only on the body but on the mind, and of course those are connected, that's a really promising way of, a new way of think of looking at poverty.
Well, even going back to some of the work that you're doing, Jeff, in Camden, which is it is a team approach. So you've got people who are following these high chronic users of the healthcare system. Sounds like establishing relationships with them and trying to help them deal with some of the things we've been talking about.
That's right. So the balance, the axis of the work is to both be very effective, which is relationship driven, but also be efficient, meaning that we don't get disorganized. So it's a very data-driven process. We run a health information exchange, so we get real-time data feeds from the local hospitals. We use that data to identify people who've had two or more inpatient visits in 6 months, which makes you an outlier. Mm-hmm. We go right up to the bedside and engage the patient. Then we go to their home within 48 hours, go with them to their primary care appointment, to their specialty appointments, to the Board of Social Services, and stick to them like glue for 90 days. And it's all relationship building. So in the studies, the exit studies we've done, and we ask patients what's important about the intervention, the overwhelming finding is the importance of a stable relationship, the importance of a trusting relationship, and the importance of our staff making a promise and following through.
Wow.
And then this issue of adverse childhood events. And you start to put all that together, and you've got people who didn't form stable attachments in childhood, and you know, and they're responding very well to a team that's forming stable attachments. There's a category of people that are like a light switch. We have a profound effect on them. And then another category of people we have almost no effect on.
Oh, that's interesting.
And we're trying to really sort out the differences in the two categories.
But it all boils down to a relationship.
Yes.
I mean, the importance, I mean, that should not surprise us.
No one changes without a meaningful relationship in any human behavior ever. It's because someone who cared about you said something over and over.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and that's Jeffrey Brenner. He's the founder and executive director of the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers, also medical director of Cooper University's Hospitals Urban Health Institute. Also with us is Angela Duckworth. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and both of them recipients this year of the MacArthur Fellowship Awards. And we're talking about their work, where they converge, where they diverge, and obviously spending some time talking about some of the fascinating research that they've been doing, and obviously giving them some kudos for getting a MacArthur Fellowship Award. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This Frank Hendricks patient, not his real name, profiled in the New Yorker, was 500 pounds and had a myriad of problems. In the article in the New Yorker, he had lost a lot of weight, and it sounded like he was doing much, much better. How is he today? What's an update on him?
No, he's passed away.
And oh, he did?
Yeah, I kept very close touch with him for a long time. And you know what? A lot of the people that we meet as high utilizers are in their last stages of life.
Really?
So it's hard to undo 30 years of damage. That's not true for all of them, but it's quite true for many of them.
And was he part of that group that you felt that you could reach out to that was amenable to some kind of intervention?
And I think we had a big impact. I mean, he'd been in the ICU twice in 6 months, which is pretty extreme.
Yes.
And had been just frequently in and out of the hospital and stayed out for quite a while. He reengaged with his family. He started going to church. He reengaged with his partner and just really had made a lot of changes.
What did he die of?
Probably heart failure. I mean, right. You know, he didn't have an autopsy, so we don't know all the details, but right. It was probably in the end heart failure.
Yeah.
And an MI.
And an MI. What is that?
Myocardial infarction, heart attack.
I got you. Angela, let me go back to you and you know, wondering about how as I realize you're in the beginning of some of this research about in terms of applying it to schools, where would you like to take it? I mean, where are you going with some of these ideas?
Yeah, we think that, as Jeffrey was pointing out, it's hard to undo, you know, 30 years of bad choices. And I think that is what draws me to children and to schools, because it's earlier in this narrative. And so often you find that there are either vicious or virtuous cycles, you know, depending which tide pool you actually end up in. So we're hoping to get kids into more virtuous cycles. Our work in particular focuses on middle school kids, so starting around the age of 10 or 11 years old. I find that a particularly interesting age group, in part because it's before the onslaught of adolescent hormones, and it's just very hard to work with teenagers and get them to, you know, encode a totally new message when they are, frankly, concerned with other things.
Sure.
And the other reason, I think, is because a lot of kids are actually now making the transition between elementary school to middle school just at that juncture. And that tends to be a point in time where kids will diverge in their trajectories. And for some kids, it actually is the beginning of a vicious cycle of school disengagement, of sort of not feeling part of the group, and, you know, then impulsivity, and then kind of just going downward. So we are looking at school-based interventions. We're thinking that that would be the way to scale. It's not that we don't think parents are important. They're obviously important. I believe that strongly as a parent myself of a 10, 12-year-old, but it's unclear to me how I would reach, you know, thousands, if not more, parents, and whereas schools, you know, there's sort of a vector for that, if you will. I think in addition to kind of anything that we would test out and try and say, oh, in this random assignment study, we found an effect on self-control or grit, I think really the ultimate lever for change is to then teach teachers what we found and why deeply, right, not superficially, and see whether that might shift school practice and culture. Mm. It was only through that constant reinforcement, I think, that could you ever hope to get a long-term sustained effect on children's behavior.
Because you need to engage children, obviously, in their academics and their courses. And if they're engaged in an interesting way, I'm assuming some of these features then will come out, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's often debated in policy circles whether this interest in character, or some people call it social-emotional right. learning, you know, whether this is actually going to threaten academic work. And to the contrary, my deep belief is that these things are mutually reinforcing. You simply can't learn very much when you cannot control your attention, your behavior, and emotion in school. And when you're doing well in school, it actually makes it easier for you to now, mm-hmm. you know, allocate some of your energy towards these other things. So really, I think that these things go hand in hand. And so I think it's by introducing these skills, these strategies, and this understanding, maybe even just you could say this perspective into schooling, teachers who are the ultimate, you know, the ones who kind of have to carry this baton mm-hmm. could really think about their work as both. So when you're teaching a math lesson, you know, how do we do this in a way that is clearly obviously emphasizes the math, but also is signaling to kids, you know, that self-control and grit are needed. And by the way, here's how you might actually exercise it a little better than you have been.
Are you concerned that schools and perhaps parents are too concerned about protecting their kids from failure?
Well, you know, I think it's a yuppie thing, right? The kind of bubble wrapping your kid. In fact, I think the Philadelphia Magazine had a picture of a kid like fully encased in bubble wrap. I found it very funny. It's, by the way, I think a very understandable impulse as somebody who, you know, herself is sort of, you know, every nick and bruise and tear, you know, you just want the best for your kids. And I think that's true of all of us, you know, not just the, you know, one socioeconomic stratum sure. or another. Now, the challenge is, I mean, as Nietzsche told us, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I mean, every parent is worried about what would actually kill the kid. I mean, you know, it's very, very hard to make those decisions in life, I think, as a teacher or a parent. I would say this, that children are like adults. They adapt to their circumstances. And if you create a friction-free circumstance for your child, that's what they will adapt to. If you wonder, like, why can't you make a piece of toast, or, you know, how can you not, you know, bounce back after just getting a B-? Well, if that's the environment to which they've adapted, we shouldn't be surprised.
Hmm. I'd be curious about your thoughts. It's interesting sort of toggling back and forth between the two of you.
I was just thinking my 6 and 9-year-old Violet and Finn are in Philadelphia Public School. And given what's going on in the public school district, I think there's nothing that's better at creating grit. They're going to be off the grit chart after 12 years in the Philadelphia school district.
But I mean, seriously, though, it's important to have adversity, you're saying? I mean, clearly, kids across this city are having to deal with adversity.
Absolutely.
As are the teachers.
You know, I think you need some amount of adversity without too much. Right. And, you know, I think there's a point when your coping skills get flooded and overwhelmed and, you know, no one can respond to that. I think often in Camden, as I look back in my patients, we love hero stories about kids who make it out of Camden or out of, you know, our poor neighborhoods in Philly. What we don't look at is the other 90% or 80% who didn't make it out, or if they did make it out, are very damaged and never reached their full life potential. So I think there's just so much work to do in figuring out different strategies for different segments of kids and adults and how we reach all of them. You know, this feels to me like a classic business challenge, which if Procter & Gamble can segment the marketplace of consumers so that every one of us can buy the clothes and the products we want, why can't we segment the marketplace of need within schools, within healthcare settings, within, you know, Bratton essentially did this within an entire city, and make sure that we've developed workflows and very specific programs to meet the needs of all these populations.
Let me pick up on that after this very short break. That's Jeffrey Brenner. He's the founder, executive director of the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. Also with us, Angela Duckworth. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and both of our guests received the MacArthur Award this year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener offers graduate degree programs including physical therapy designed to give students real-world experience in student-led physical therapy clinics. Widener graduate programs are designed to combine challenging and engaging classroom work with applied learning to help jumpstart your career. Learn more at an open house on Tuesday, October 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration at widener.edu/leadership. Widener Leadership Works.
I'm Marty Moscowane. When times are tough, where do you go to get in-depth and reliable news, analysis, and information? It's WHYY and programs like Radio Times. We're not about sound bites and shouting. We're better than that, and so are you. Take the next few minutes and support the programs that you enjoy. Become a supporter of WHYY by calling 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theatre Company presents Jane Austen's Emma, extended through Sunday, November 3rd only. 200 years after its publication, Emma continues to delight audiences, both as a coming-of-age tale and a lively satire of Austen's elegant and quirky characters. This sparkling stage adaptation features a spectacle of regency, dance, revelry, and romance that will welcome new audiences into Austen's witty world while captivating longtime fans. Details online at lanterntheatre.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Every year when the MacArthur Fellowships are awarded, it's pretty big news. It's a coveted prize, and it recognizes achievement and supports a diverse group of people who are doing work that has been showing some great promise. Two recipients in the Philadelphia area were winners, and we wanted to acknowledge them on Radio Times. Again, Angela Duckworth is a psychologist whose area of expertise is something she calls grit self-control. We've been talking about that. Jeffrey Brenner is a Camden physician who's been doing some pioneering work delivering health care to the urban poor. We've been talking about that as well. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Francine from, looks like Newbold, joining us on Radio Times. Francine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
First of all, I want to say that you make a fascinating point regarding the fact that people who have gone through a consistently stressful situation, children or adults, over an extended period of time, perhaps evolutionarily will adapt by becoming extremely reactive. Right. And along those lines, I was thinking of two groups of populations who could be benefited, perhaps extra much, would be through the autistic population and also those who have suffered through post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure.
And I just wanted to get both of the researchers' thoughts on that.
Francine, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Have you, Angela, looked at autism and how that might apply to the work you've been doing?
haven't. We haven't looked at autism or kids who you would say were on the spectrum, right, for autistic symptomology, nor have we specifically looked at post-traumatic growth. But I think the caller's, you know, making, you know, important points. So whatever the kind of adversity it is, you know, to look at how people have really, in a way, rationally adapted, even if it's not, it's maladaptive really, but there's some kind of, you know, understandable way that they've been adapting to their circumstances.
Yeah, and the PTSD part of it, Jeff, some thoughts about that. I mean, I, just to sort of acknowledge what you had said before, which is there is so much trauma that people do experience, so many people do experience, and it seems to me it's one of the issues that we ignore, I mean, really at our peril.
One of the outcomes of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq has been much more comfort, I think, in the public dialogue to talk about trauma. And, you know, it's acceptable to talk about veterans with trauma, but I think we get very uncomfortable when we talk about poor people with early life trauma, or frankly, anyone with early life trauma. The medical community just shuts down. It's not something we're comfortable dealing with. Even the behavioral health community is frankly uncomfortable as well. They've created like niche specialty that deals with this, but it's so common that it needs to be broadly disseminated. We have world-class research going on at Drexel being led by someone named Sandra Bloom, building out what she's calling a sanctuary model, which is recognizing that traumatized people, when they interact with social service organizations, schools, prisons, can be incredibly disruptive to those organizations, and that appropriately handling those patients requires an organization-wide approach. So she's been really doing some groundbreaking work thinking about, you know, in a clinic, how would you train the front desk and the managers and the doctors and everyone to be on the same page so that you're presenting a really united model of care to very traumatized people?
I'm curious why you think there's reluctance within the medical community to deal with sort of domestic trauma as opposed to war trauma.
You know, we've put ourselves in this box called the 10-minute primary care visit. And no matter who you are, you get whacked with the 10-minute hammer. It could be a head cold, or it could be a patient just recently discharged from the hospital with open heart surgery, or someone who's had life trauma. So my teaching in residency was don't pull up a lid that you don't have the training and the time to appropriately deal with. And I think that was absolutely wrong. We have got to figure out how to build models of care for trauma that are widely disseminated across all of these different human endeavors, that it's not a niche specialty where we're all comfortable talking about it because the prevalence is stunning.
Mm. What's interesting to me is you're using business models, you're using data, I mean, sort of, you know, hardcore, sort of unemotional arguments to make your point.
You know, the reason that America is such a wealthy place is the last 100 years, we brought incredible thinking and critical analysis to building products, making cars, doing all sorts of things. Now we need to do the same thing to the least productive sectors in our economy. Mm-hmm. Education and healthcare are the least productive sectors. And I think the same tools that we use to solve all those other business problems should all come over into healthcare and education and solve our problems there.
And it's interesting, you both are working in these institutions. You just rolled your eyes at me, Angela. Go ahead.
I absolutely agree. I see it more, of course, in education, which is where I spend a lot of my time. But if you think about, you know, how have we made such great strides in certain fields, right? You know, the iPad is great, right? Like, why haven't we done a similar thing in teaching and learning, which have got to be two of the most important functions of any society? And I think it is a cultural shift, right? So that we can, you know, in countries like Finland, teachers consider themselves, all of them, not just a small number of them, they're all researchers, they're all scientists, they're all trying to figure out, you know, what if I did this? You know, and then I measured the change in my practice, what would happen, and can I, in a more rigorous way, you know, sort of look at that? And I think that that would be the greater hope from, you know, nothing that my own little lab does, or even in my lab plus its collaborators, but really to have a shift in the educational culture to say, you know, these questions are amenable to the scientific method and to the technological innovation cycles, you know, rapid prototyping, measuring, going right back, you know, with just enough data, going back again, version 2.0, version 3.0 and up. That would be the major, I think, win for education.
And you're talking about applying the data. I mean, getting the data and then using it in the classroom.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's, of course, a challenge and easier said than done. But, you know, let's see how far we can get if we try it.
When you talk about grit, is that also related to resilience? I mean, how some people, for whatever reason, they get knocked down, they get up and they keep going.
Yeah, different people define resilience in different ways, but I think one very common definition is coming back from adversity, mm-hmm. and that's absolutely part of grit, and that's why certain questions on the grit scale have to do with coming back after setbacks and disappointment. But there are other questions, too, which don't have to do with that and have to do with really having sustained commitments or interests over time. Mm-hmm. And I guess, it's not just resilience.
Do you see resilience in your work, Jeff?
Being hospitalized is a teachable moment where you get to make new decisions in life. So we're finding a whole category of people who work with our teams and begin to make much, much better decisions and really turn their life around. And that's a kind of resilience that when someone reaches out a hand and offers you help, that you're able to take that and accommodate and change.
Because it requires that sort of trust, that belief that perhaps if I do this, things will get better.
That's right. So there's some hope built into it. Absolutely.
We find that in our work. So we're interested in particular in what are the antecedents of grit. So grit's great, but, how do you get more of it?
Right.
And, we find a pattern in our data that people who truly do have hope, so we would call it optimistic explanatory style, when something bad happens, do you spontaneously think about causes, if it's a bad event, that are specific and changeable as opposed to global and permanent? And those people who are more optimistic, who can reach and say, this was a total disaster, but this specific cause can be remediated. Those are the people who, of course, try harder. So I think grit mm-hmm. does derive in part from this optimistic mindset. And the other pattern, I think it's very similar, is people have a growth mindset. People who believe that human nature is fundamentally changeable and that the way things are aren't necessarily the way things are going to be. Right. Those people also are more gritty.
Well, and that's optimism too, isn't it? That things will, it's evolution, but it's optimism as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's hard, actually. I have to say, I'm somebody who knows that that's true, and I'm becoming more of a growth mindset person, but it's so very easy to dwell on the way things are and just to feel like they're just going to be that way forever.
Especially with the government shutdown.
Yes, that's true.
That does not
make you a pessimist.
And that does not help. Francine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499, touching on a bunch of important things in this hour of Radio Times. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. In fact, we have an email from Christine. She wants to know, and this is, I guess, to you, Angela, what role does self-confidence play in the grit equation?
So I think that self-confidence, interesting, self-confidence is a term that all of us know, but psychologists rarely study. I guess we have jargon for everything. They study what's called self-efficacy, and that is the belief that if you try, you can do something, and I guess that's what self-confidence really is. So self-efficacy, to me, is clearly one of the precursors to grit. So if you ask, why would Jeffrey keep doing what he's doing,
yes.
Clinics getting shut down,
yes.
boarded up, being in debt, et cetera, I'm going to guess here that at some deep level, you did have self-efficacy. You believe that ultimately you could prevail. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense for you to keep going. That's one thing we see about gritty people, but they need not only self-efficacy, they also need to have high, high value on that goal, and they have to be able to put up with the costs. So the costs of doing, so the benefits have to be high, the expectation of success has to be high, and the costs have to be acceptable.
Well, and that also sounds like the stubbornness that you were talking about as well, Jeff.
A very thick skull.
but do you see yourself in what Angela just said?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very true. And, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about my employees and the partners we work with and just, which employees succeed mm-hmm. in different environments. And all the things that you're saying about grit also make for great employees as well.
Yeah, I'm looking for gritty people all the time.
Yeah. But is the opposite of a gritty person a lazy person? Are we talking about laziness as the other side? Because that's such a loaded word.
Yeah, exactly. I think the problem with lazy is, what do you mean? I mean, oftentimes I think we say things like lazy or dumb when we just don't know why this person is being so frustratingly uncooperative. And so we just label it, right? But it's not very helpful because it doesn't tell you what exactly mm-hmm. is going on. So if a child, for example, has low self-confidence, low self-efficacy, and that's why they give up every time they try a hard math problem, I don't think we really should label that as lazy. Or if they just don't see the point, right? Like, you keep telling them, like, oh, well, you know, in 25 years, you might be an engineer. But that's not a valuable thing, at least in their own minds at that point. I don't think that's laziness, right? And then, you know, if they experience the cost of effort, interestingly, mental effort is aversive as a it just has the feeling of being aversive. So if they maybe sense that more and they haven't, you know, developed a tolerance for that distress, I don't know whether lazy is an appropriate label for that either. So I think really we should just be asking hard questions about what's really going on and resist kind of, you know, labels that you slap on but don't provide any insight.
Let me get James from Mayfair to join us on Radio Times. And James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This question's for Angela more than anything else. As a youth wrestling coach in Philadelphia, we talk about grit a lot and what makes our wrestlers successful, but what also makes them successful in education and in future life. Angela, can you talk a little bit about extracurricular activities and its influence on grit?
James, thanks for the call.
Two quick notes. I, by the way, get lots of great emails from coaches, and I really learn from every one of them. The first thing I'll say is that there's another way to measure grit other than a questionnaire, and that is by, for example, in high school students, counting up the number of years that they have actually pursued extracurriculars like sports, also paid work or political, you know, whatever, or student government, and saying, you know, the grittier the kid, the more we should see evidence of multi-year commitments and progression in those commitments. So I absolutely think that, you know, extracurriculars are possibly, you know, a more common way actually that kids develop and show grit than maybe just their academics. So that's one thing I would say about that. The other thing is I have a strong bias towards hiring serious athletes in my lab, and it's not because athletes know more about psychology. It's because they have it through training, through coaching, through winning matches and through losing matches, figured out how to learn from feedback, get right back up again, wake up in the morning, try hard again. They've been terrific, and you know, I'll continue to do that.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get to, it looks like Ann from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Ann, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
Dr. Brenner, I've been a great admirer of yours ever since I read Dr. Gawande's article in the New Yorker. My background is in public health, and I was struck by the lack of mention even of the public health system. Mm. All of these syndromes and problems have been known to the public health theory for many years, and they're called precursor conditions. And I've often heard providers complain that they have to mop up the problems that the public health system misses. And I'm wondering what your assessment is of the lack of relationship between healthcare providers and the public health system.
And thanks for the call. Go ahead, Jeff.
I'm going to say something perhaps provocative and unpopular with my colleagues in the public health field. If you look at what we did with MAPS and how we've analyzed the problem, we very much used the traditional social determinants framework from public health, which says there are all these life forces and all these social variables out in the community that impact people's health that result in ill health and hospitalization. So we use that framework. But what public health does a very poor job of is prioritization. Public health is one inch deep across way too many problems and way too much geography. And I frankly got overwhelmed by the social determinants framework because it's a fairly hopeless framework, which is if I don't cure poverty in Camden, I'll never make an impact. So, you know, we're a tertiary care prevention organization, meaning that I'm not worried about primary and secondary prevention. I want to focus on people who've already had events and keep them from having another event. But the problem with public health is that you get really ginned up and angry and focused on all the problems in the system, but you get none of the tools that you need to fix it. And all the tools to fix these problems are business tools: segmentation, workflow analysis, delegation, standardization, protocolization. So I'm deeply disappointed with our educators on public health for not teaching young people how to actually fix the problems that they are upset about.
And again, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jeff, final question to you. We're almost out of time here. Do you think the Affordable Care Act, I mean, it's being both attacked and folded out or unfolded, I guess I should say. Does that in any way deal with some of what you are dealing with?
There's two halves to the Affordable Care Act. One is how to cover everyone. And the other is how to deliver better care at lower cost.
Right.
And we're not having a lot of discussion about that second half. We're all fighting about the first half. At some point, we're going to get over this mess and we'll have a lot more people covered. But having a healthcare card is an empty promise in America. It doesn't mean you're going to get great care every day for everyone. So There's a lot of innovation around. There's $10 billion of innovation funding. We've gotten some of that funding in Camden. Other sites around the country have gotten those grants. And there's a lot of opportunities for payment reform. The way we pay for healthcare is wrong in America.
Well, my congratulations to both of you for getting this MacArthur Award and also for the work that you're doing. And it's great to have you back together or back on Radio Times, but to have you together again. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jeffrey Brenner, founder, executive director of the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. Angela Duckworth, associate professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can learn much more about this program. Stay with us for hour two.